study and teaching of writing at The Ohio State University. This is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. David Rakoff is the New York Times best-selling author of Don't Get Too Comfortable and Fraud. His latest collection of essays is titled Half Empty. He is a regular contributor to This American Life on Public Radio International. Welcome to Writer's Talk, David Rakoff.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Steve Stevens of the Columbus Dispatch recently published a piece that said that asked if you were bringing a message of, quote, jocular despair to Central Ohio.
Yes, and I thought that was actually a really good term, jocular despair. I thought it was a perfect term, in fact.
Why is it a perfect term? Why does that describe you?
Because it doesn't take either element of that expression too seriously. It doesn't elevate the joking to sort of noble medicinal qualities. And the despair is not the kind of despair that keeps one in bed all day and would best be described as mental illness. It's a kind of more systemic melancholia, a way of seeing the world that doesn't rob you of your agency.
Paralyzing despair.
No,
does not.
It's not.
Okay.
Okay. Paralyzing despair.
How did you arrive at that? Tell me about you're from Canada.
Yes.
And we always take the Canadians to be cheerful.
Really?
I don't know. I'm just saying.
No, the Canadians are. If there is a national character, the Canadians are actually closer to the Scandinavians, if you think about it.
Well, it's a northern climb.
So there's a certain kind of unflappable, almost melancholia there. But that's neither here nor there because my parents were immigrants so I arrived at it in the way that anybody arrives at their essential character. It was certainly pre-verbal. It was potentially pre-conscious. Who knows? But I was always I always gravitated towards the melancholic end of the spectrum, just in terms of affect. Mm-hmm. So it was not a choice that I made. It's not like I got to college and suddenly reinvented myself and gave myself a French name or something like that. Mm-hmm. I did, however, in college, paint Van Gogh's sunflowers in large format on my dorm room wall because I thought that'd be really cool and artistic.
But did it end up being cool and artistic?
It did.
That was the consensus.
It was kind of cool. It was, a fairly good likeness of Van Gogh's sunflowers that I painted.
Okay.
Yeah, it was kind of cool. But this is not that. This is just, this is my third book, and it's not as if the sensibility of the previous two books, or indeed of everything that I've written, hasn't already been through the same lens. I mean, it all comes out of my brain. And because I am fortunate enough to, if not always write in the first person, but am allowed to be present in the writing, while at the same time have the great good fortune of not having to be a memoirist, more on that in a bit, It has always been my sensibility is to be somewhat more melancholic.
Okay. Why the great good fortune to not be a memoirist? I've seen you object to that phrase.
I do. I really bridle at memoirs.
That's why I didn't use it. You used it first.
I know. Because you didn't want, as we used to say in literary circles, a knuckle sandwich.
Right.
That's right.
You didn't want me to
give you what for.
Right. Interesting literary circles you're traveling in. It's more Hemingway-esque.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the thing is, you just have to look at me to know that I'm all brawn. Mm-hmm. I'm all...
Right, yeah. I got the same...
The fists flying first and ask questions
excellent.
Later.
That's why it's... you can see on the cover of your book...
Just
you
a
have
violent...
With violent,
kind of
angry.
He-Man kind of book. Yeah. That's me.
So memoirist, not you. Why?
Not me, because I always bridle at the term for a variety of reasons. One is that just if one were to read my actual writing, it's extremely guarded in its personal revelation. Mm-hmm. This book is more personal than my previous books. But generally, if I'm writing about myself, an experience that I've had, it's an experience that I've gone out to have in order to write about it. I very rarely write about my life such as it is. And if I do, it's almost always in the past, in a very, very past kind of way. Mm-hmm. Also, I don't write about my family. I mean, I acknowledge that they exist. I'm not, I wasn't raised on some.
Now that is in no way the
petri
most
dish, you know,
guarded statement I've ever heard someone say about a family. I acknowledge that they exist.
You know what I mean? I wasn't right. raised on some smear of agar gel in a petri dish. I have a family, you know. So, but I don't write about them. I don't write about my love life. I don't write about my romantic life or my sex life. It's just, I don't do it. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I'm really not a memoirist. The other thing is that I think that we've reached a point culturally where not only is there a glut of memoir on the market, but so many of the memoirs rely upon the harrowing nature of the tale that they're telling, to the real detriment and complete ignoring of notions of craft. Do you know what I mean? The fact mm-hmm. that your father dispatched the rest of your family through a wood chipper on Christmas Eve mm-hmm. is really the crux of the book. And whether or not you tell the story well is secondary. Mm-hmm. That's not sort of how I feel about writing. I'd rather be known for my capacity for language and an ability to render things accurately or vividly than I am the particulars of my biography.
Okay.
That said, I'm aware that that's a little line that I'm choosing to walk, and there may well be people who have read my stuff who are saying to themselves while watching this, who does he think he's kidding? But that's okay. my little story that I tell myself. It's not really for me to say whether that's true. I hope it's true. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm not a memoirist for all those reasons that I just okay. cited. But
well, that interests me because you've done a lot of work for This American Life.
Yes.
And you're often associated with David Sedaris.
Yes.
Who I think walks a different line.
Yes, very much so. And so, David, you know, is one of my best friends, and I really feel that I owe David my entire career.
But so let's talk about David. No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, it is a different, and everybody makes these choices, and I'm not questioning the choices. I'm curious about what leads to them, you know? I mean, you've got somebody like David Sedaris, who's exceptionally well-known, and I think incredibly funny, but he's taking a different line. And,
yes.
and everybody gets to make that choice. But, you know, when you're with him and you're talking about writing and you're saying, does that come up? Do you say, how do you, you know, David, how do you reveal
Oh, when it? I'm with him, I thought right. you were about to say when one is with him. David and I are very close, but we've never really had that conversation, which mm-hmm. is interesting. I think also, and this is a complete sidebar, I think David, for all his fame and all his prominence, does not get enough credit for being as fine a writer as I think he is. Mm-hmm. I think almost nobody ends an essay as beautifully as David does. I mean, almost every single one ends in beautiful, beautiful prose. And I actually think that David needs constant reassessment as a real craftsman.
As a prose.
Truly, as a prose craftsman, yeah. I think he's really, in addition to being screamingly funny, and he really is screamingly funny, mm-hmm. and in addition to personally owing him my career, I think he's just a marvelous writer. But we've never discussed the choice of material. It's just about a comfort level. Mm-hmm. And I think that even David himself would acknowledge to you that the version of his family that is presented in his work is a somewhat reified version.
Right.
Of his actual family.
He's written about that. And there's one essay that I think addresses both of these that he talks about, and not to get into talking about his writing too much. But
yeah, why don't you just call David if you love David so
right,
much?
Yeah, I know. Because he's not, you know,
We couldn't get him. He's too expensive.
But the thing about that, the essay that I'm thinking about is the one that ends, he's got the parrot in it. And,
saying, I'm sorry, I'm
right,
sorry.
I'm sorry. And that is a really beautiful, poignant ending.
Yes.
In the same way that you're talking about. But it also requires him to admit, I think, you know, that there is a certain amount of being the writer and taking sort of advantage of the things like that, where you can, you know, go back and hopefully your family accepts it, because I've certainly talked to writers whose families did not accept it.
Sure, and I'd rather not be in that position, so I don't do it. I mean,
right.
that's the thing. I would just rather not be
right.
put into that position.
That's not just your family, but that's everybody. That's anybody.
Everybody in my life. And you know, the Joan Didion quote, writers are always selling somebody out.
Mm-hmm.
Yes and no. Is my hope as regards my own writing. It is one reason that I find reporting, I used to joke that I was the worst reporter in the world. You know, I'm not the worst reporter in the world anymore. I've gotten somewhat better.
Why were you saying you were the worst reporter? What was not
for precisely
well?
Those reasons? For a variety of reasons, actually, I find it tremendously difficult to be among people, just in general. I turn out to be a very shy individual, but you know, I'm not a kid. I'm 46 years old, so I've learned the compensatory. How sure. does one say that?
We're going to go with compensatory.
Okay, let's say compensatory.
But I'm not guaranteeing it's right.
Well, for the purposes of this conversation, let's just say compensatory.
Yeah, okay.
So I've learned those compensatory coping strategies where I can now walk into a room and conduct myself without, you know, dying inside of too much shyness. But that said, I do find it difficult to sort of just approach people and start talking. Mm-hmm. And even more than that, ask them questions. It makes me shy, even though that extreme self-consciousness is entirely internal. I know that to the rest of the world, all those things that I think are screamingly obvious, the rest of the world looks and says, oh, dark hair. I mean, literally, I understand that, mm-hmm. that people don't really respond to me in the way that I fear that they're responding. But I find it also tremendously difficult to ask questions whose answers strike me as being obvious or axiomatic. But if you're reporting a story, you have to ask them. So I would never want to ask a man who is standing among the charred remains of his home, okay, wearing clothing that is soiled with ash and perhaps the last remaining streaks of blood of his now dead family. I don't want to ask him, how are you feeling right now? Mm-hmm. To me, it seems quite obvious. I can surmise how he's feeling. And the answer would be some variation on not good. You know, so for that reason, I find reporting very difficult.
Did you have that? I'm just curious. Did you have an experience when you started out that was not maybe that extreme, but something that you said, okay, here's the line that I'm never going to cross? Because that scenario is clear. But there are scenarios that are in the middle that are harder to make the argument about, or you're harder to figure out where you come down.
And well, yes, this is the big problem, because I also fancy myself as a somewhat empathetic fellow. Mm-hmm. So if you're empathetic in your personal life, you know, I am the person people tell secrets to, and I guard all those secrets. So I fancy myself, whether delusional or not, as being able to essentially glean human nature. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So there are a lot of things that I would be saying, well, of course he doesn't feel such and such, or she doesn't feel such and such, or it follows naturally that this is the case. But if you're reporting a story, you can't write that. Mm-hmm. You actually have to ask that question. I'm not so good at that. I've gotten better. But the selling out of people, I don't really do it. I try to remain really vigilant about my targets. Look, I obviously say a lot of...
Targets instead of subjects, but we'll come back to that.
Well, I mean, I'm talking in terms of if I say something somewhat biting or for humorous effect, mm-hmm. therefore a target as opposed to a subject. So if I'm rendering them a target, I try to be really vigilant about why am I doing it, thinking of this person as a target. So generally they would have to be either a public figure or someone who somehow deserved it. Mm-hmm. You know, I've said some really biting things, for example, about the former president, George W. Bush's mother, Barbara Bush. She deserved it. A, she's a public figure. B, it was in response to some pretty horrible stuff that she had said. What I said was undoubtedly sharp, but I did not sell her out.
Well, you don't, because you don't know her, so, and she's a public figure, so that's...
There's that, and because it was done, what she said entirely merited my response. Okay. So, do you know what I mean? It's like, I didn't call her and say, boy, is she fat, you know, for no good reason. Okay. A, I didn't say it, and B, it was not some sort of ad hominem attack. So, in that sense, I don't really subscribe to the thing. I'm not always selling somebody out. I try very hard not to sell people out. And I think that one can still write good journalism without having to sell people out.
Well, you seem really concerned about, like you said, the biting and the comments and things like that. And there are times that you won't go forward with it, right? So I'm curious where that line is for you. Is it personally, if you know them, or is it something else? Where do you say, you know, this is a person who's done something maybe marginally difficult to say, but you won't go after them?
It has to be somewhat earned.
Okay.
For me to go after it. Yeah, they have to have earned it.
Okay.
But again, even as I say this to you, I feel like I'm sort of letting myself off of hooks a little bit. I wrote a piece, a chapter in a previous book about going on a Buddhist retreat led by Steven Seagal, the action hero.
Right.
And
which seemed the perfect setup, really.
Precisely, and
how
I thought that he
better?
Would really be the guy that I would go after. But it turns out that I sort of went after the people who were on the retreat with me mm-hmm. for their very terrified and reactionary fear of the world mm-hmm. and the presence of things in the world that were perhaps darker than they liked to contemplate. And that struck me and strikes me. Indeed, if this book advocates anything, this current book, it's to look at the world in all its unvarnished sadness, darkness, mm-hmm. and beauty. So I really sort of went after the people who were on this retreat with me in that way. People who, it must be said, did not ask for an undercover journalist to be writing about them. Mm-hmm. And even though I changed their names and pertinent details, it's debatable whether they deserved what they got. Mm-hmm. But again, I tried to be extremely vigilant about what I was criticizing them for. So it's, the line is, I was going to say the line is imprecise. It's not. It's an absolute line, but it is subtle and changeable and cannot be reduced to
the kinds of things
I'm
asking for.
Exactly.
Right.
But you know what I mean.
Right. But that's the thing that you have to, I think, wrestle with is saying, where is that line? When does it change? When does it move? When do I get to say this about
exactly.
that person?
And there are times when the line has been thrown out entirely in this book, and I even admit to
it. Okay. Well, so let's go to the book and talk a bit about it. You've got it. It's called Half Empty mm-hmm. rather than Half Full. So this suggests a certain viewpoint.
Yes.
And I'd like to know, how do you combat the negativity about pessimism? How do you combat, both from in two ways, one from people saying you should be more of an optimist, you
yes.
should look at the world and be happy as the little bunnies are on the front cover. They seem happy. Although I have to say, I just noticed the double barrel shotgun aiming at the rabbit and on the front cover.
Yes, the entire landscape is a rebus of potential disaster. There's it's an idyllic setting. And of course you see that the mountain in the distance is a volcano
right.
and the happy canoeist is about to meet his maker over a waterfall and mm-hmm. Yes, and even the flowers are those Venus flytraps.
Oh, right, yeah, I didn't, man.
And the banner that the Bluebirds of Happiness are carrying is torn and patched.
Mm-hmm.
So, but still, it's beautiful.
Right.
So there you
go. On first glance, but then the world is revealed to be a horrible place that will kill you.
Or as I like to call it, the world.
The world.
The world is revealed to be the world.
World.
So how do I combat... Okay.
So when people say, be more of an optimist, be more of an optimist in your writing, partially, I mean, I read something like this and I think it's an affectation in some ways it's a way of dealing with the world that leads to comedy, because you've got warning, no inspirational life lessons will be found in these pages. That's your cover warning. You know,
yes.
like Tipper Gore used to have the things on the front of CDs.
Exactly.
You know, so... but it may, I look at it, and the thing that I thought was, there's no inspirational comedy. Comedy, you know, tell me what an inspirational comedy would be. You come out of it feeling...
No, an inspirational comedy...
Would be not funny, I think.
No, you're right. It would be death to comedy. In the use of that... In the use of inspirational, as we think of it as being mm. somehow...
There are comedies that make you feel good.
Or that inspire you to want to go home and do good work.
Right.
Not good works, but good work. Good writing.
Good
work.
Writing, right.
Yes.
But you don't leave a comedy, because there's always that sense of something has to be, you know, we have to be tearing the cover off something that we thought was the Bluebird of Happiness, but the Bluebird of Happiness is carrying a banner that's ripping.
Yes. I mean, that's so, the nature of humor is to show the world in all its...
Right.
Is to deconstruct something. I think the only inspirational comedy that I can think of is Sullivan's Travels by Preston Sturges.
Right.
With, you know, Joel McRae and Veronica.
I'm trying to remember how it ends, because he goes back and decides to work
you know,
for the people.
And he says, Well, you know, it's about a comedy director who wants to make a very inspirational movie called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, mm-hmm. which is where the Coen brothers got the name. And it's in the middle of the Depression. He wants to really go out and show the common man. And through a series of mishaps, he finds himself on a chain gang and everything. The film has a brilliant monologue at the beginning by Sullivan, the director's butler, who says to him, basically, you think of poverty as being the lack of something, but it's not the lack of something. It's a present and clear, rapacious thing. It eats away at things. It's an active, terrible thing, and you're romanticizing it, basically telling that he's full of it and he doesn't get it. So Sullivan goes off and he has his, and it's a very funny but a brilliant movie. And then Sullivan comes back and he's ensconced in Hollywood and he realizes the nobility of what he does. And he says something like, you know something, there's a lot, words to these effect, there's a lot to making, said to make, for making people laugh. It's all some people have in this cockamamie parade or something like that, mm-hmm. you know, one of those. And it's terrific. It's a little self-aggrandizing and certainly in the decades since that wonderful movie, it has been invoked and used to justify a lot of very self-congratulatory douchebag comedians. Mm-hmm. Am I allowed to say that word
Here? They may take it out.
Okay.
But we'll find out. So you've got
so
this.
So you don't have inspirational comedy.
You don't have inspirational.
The cover burst is essentially a lot of horse trading goes on in a publishing company between mm-hmm. authors who don't want subtitles and publishers who don't just want your name. Mm-hmm. Let's leave it at that.
Okay. I was going to say how much say you had in this, because it seems
The cover I had almost all say in, okay. and I think they listened to me so closely, and they did a beautiful job. Okay. But marketing language is, it's the nature of the beast.
Okay. Well, tell me about your work for This American Life. What's the difference between writing for the ear and writing for the eye, and what's your attraction to doing radio?
Well, writing for the ear and writing for the eye are different in the following ways. And I've said this before because the question comes up a lot. And so forgive me if you've heard me say this before. When you're writing on the radio, for the radio, you're leading people along a string in the dark. You're telling them a story. Mm-hmm. And it's like this. And if you let them let go of the string, you cannot get them back. They are lost to you and you are lost to them. So you have to keep things lean. And when you're writing on the page, at least for me, I'm allowed to be, for want of a better term, boring. You're presenting someone with a set of plans. So I can say to you, okay, here's where it's going to be the kitchen, and this is a garden. Oh, and look over here, this is where I used to go to school. So back at the kitchen, and you can sort of see it all, and I can digress, and I can go on tangents, and the danger of that is much less so when you're presented with this set of plans.
Okay.
So it's a lot fatter than radio writing. And I was going to say something terribly penetrating and interesting, and of course lost my train of thought.
I think I get what you're going at. You're talking about the sort of the cognitive work you need to do as a listener.
As a listener,
versus
exactly.
What you do as a reader, where you have control over that as a reader. You can say, wait a minute, where did he say the kitchen was?
Exactly.
You go back, you read it, you're okay. Whereas in the radio, I mean, podcasts may change this, may be changing this, but you don't typically move backwards in time.
You have to go, and you have to do a lot of stuff, even the little things. When someone reappears, you have to parenthetically give their Homeric moniker mm-hmm. one more time.
Okay. Now, I don't want to shortchange this, but I do want to ask you about the writing of this new book. During the writing of this new book, you were diagnosed with cancer. It was a reoccurrence for you. And how did you work through that? I mean, how did that, you've talked about it before, and you're actually remaining optimistic about it,
sure.
which, given your writing,
yes.
is perhaps a little surprising.
no.
Maybe.
Well, go on.
But go on. So, you know, what did that, when you're dealing with things like pessimism, and you're dealing with these difficult life situations, and then something like this happens. Did that have an impact on the writing of the book? I mean, it seems to me it must have had an impact. What was that like?
Well, it certainly had an impact on the writing of the book because the book was late. And the book kept on being late because I was in a great deal of physical pain for 2 years before we found out what it was. So for 2 years, I was really rendered essentially non-operational. Like, I just couldn't get my work done. I was in too much pain. So the book was very late. And I think also the dribs and drabs of work that I was able to do during respites of pain must have colored some of the essays, or all of the essays, I'm not sure. So in that sense, the thing is imbued with physical pain. I address the being ill in the final chapter. If you're writing a book that advocates that we have reached a point culturally where we no longer leave any room for people who might see the world melancholically, not sadly and not badly, but just a somewhat darker and, again, not an unbeautiful place as a result. It was kind of my putting my money where my mouth is moment, both in terms of having to write about something rather large and hoping to do it with enough style and enough...
Craft is what you said.
Craft, right? Yes. To not be clouded by the hugeness of the personal experience. And I'll be honest, to me, it's a pretty huge personal experience to be sick again. But I didn't want that to be the loud car alarm in the background that you're hearing. I wanted the writing to be good. As for where my pessimism led me within that thing, within that experience, I do think that, in fact, I even address it where I talk about the whole notion of why me, and that it doesn't come up for me.
Why not you?
Why not you? Exactly, is what you say. Is, you know, there. It's not like I deserve it less. It's not like I deserve it more. Even though there, you know, there are aspects to both arguments to be made, but those are more personal. In terms of the optimism, it turns out that the life force, and I remember this from the 80s, during the AIDS pandemic, and I had friends who were, I lost a great many friends. I was living in New York at the time. I've lived in New York since 82. It never failed to amaze me that friends who, even though I was able to see the person that I knew and loved within the truly, like, skin-wrapped skeleton, you know, and I remember thinking, why haven't I given up yet? I mean, what is this person waiting for? Mm-hmm. It turns out that the life force is a very optimistic thing. You have to really be in much worse straits than I currently am to give up your optimism that things will essentially work out for you. Okay. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It takes a lot more than a fairly rare and fairly serious bout of cancer to make you pessimistic on that front.
I mean, I think I don't want to take away from the experience. I want to say that I think I know what you're saying, but not having gone through that, I don't want to claim that experience. Does that
make
sense?
Sure, you can say, you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
I mean, I think it's a fairly universal thing that I just said.
Okay. Well, that's great, because that means we end on an optimistic note. Which, you know, I think for the author of Half Empty, I've done a good job. So, David Rakoff, I want to thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure, on Writer's Talk and from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University. This is Doug Dangler saying, keep writing.